which leads to a dangerous friendship.
I suppose more warning bells should have chimed inside my head. Mostly, the whole incident had simply set off a sort of insatiable curiosity within me.
Book at Beach Time, The Other Typist by Suzanne Rendell. Made for 4 Extra. Throughout next week, starting on Monday afternoon at 2:30.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, it's 3:00. I'm Steve Urquhart, and this is where we get to settle back and enjoy a whole hour of classic drama. Today, Jack Shepherd, probably best known as the TB detective Wycliffe, treats us to a riveting performance as Gregory, the central character of a novel written and set just after the Second World War, but which recalls the periods just before the First World War. What does the past tell him about the present? So now, published in 1946 and cited as one of J.B. Priestley's most autobiographical novels, this is part one of Bright Day.
Is it time, chance, destiny, or is it God that keeps shuffling the pack and laying out the cards? It was June 1946, and I'd come here to the Royal Ocean Hotel in Cornwall to finish writing a script. But ever since I'd arrived, I'd been intrigued by a married couple whom I seemed to know from somewhere, but couldn't remember where, until the music brought it all back to me. The slow movement of Schubert's B-flat major trio, I knew it at once. The thin ribbon of sound pulled back curtain after curtain, and I was back again. Before the First World War, and half a lifetime away.
Stanley Mervyn here.
It's me.
Jock Bannister.
Ben.
It's us. Joe. Bridget. Eva.
And that's when I recognised the middle-aged couple sitting stiffly a few tables away. They never did like music. Malcolm and Eleanor Nixie.
Excuse me for interrupting. Lord and Lady Harmdeen,
as they were now called.
Yes.
My name is Dawson, Gregory Dawson.
I'm sorry?
I only just recognised you. We knew each other in Bruddersford years ago.
Bruddersford?
Yes, we worked together for a time at Hawes and Company, wool merchants.
Of course, I remember Bruddersford well now.
Of course, Gregory Dawson. You joined up when the war came, didn't you?
Most of us did.
Did you go back into the wool trade afterwards?
No. I got a job in Fleet Street after my demob in 19. Then, after a few years in journalism and magazine work, I wrote a novel or two and a play and finally ended up in Hollywood.
Hollywood?
Films, eh?
That's right.
You write them?
Yes.
Invent all the stuff they have to say and do.
Oh, you always were a clever boy, I remember. You were writing even in those days.
Then I was talking about it. Now I have to do it and not talk about it. So if you'll excuse me, I must go to my room and do some work.
I say, let's meet for a cocktail. Perhaps tomorrow before dinner?
Or for a coffee and a liqueur and have a chat about the good old days.
The good old days. How had I not recognised them earlier? 30 years ago, they'd been playing Malcolm Nixie and his wife Eleanor, who descended on us so suddenly from London that night at the Allingtons to take what they could from us. Perhaps in order that one day they should be Lord and Lady Harmdeen, sitting rigidly here in the Royal Ocean Hotel, wondering what the devil to do with themselves. The solitude of the hotel was just what I needed to finish the script of The Lady Hits Back. I had an enormous bedroom that wandered off into a turret where I worked, high above the glittering sea, like a man in a lighthouse. But I found I couldn't concentrate. I was being drawn back. Back more than 30 years to 1912 when I was 18.
It's me, Jo. Bridget. Eva.
To Bruddersford in Yorkshire. The Allington family and their friends. Always suddenly and magically they would appear on the trams that went swaying and groaning down Waverley Road. They were an unknown tribe. Strange and fascinating.
You didn't.
But it was the three girls, sisters, who transfixed me. I stared at them and wished I could be a part of their group and join them in their enchanted land. I had been considering going up to Cambridge after leaving school, but I couldn't make up my mind. Meanwhile, I needed to earn a living.
Mr. Allington?
Mr. Ackworth.
Greggy Dawson's here. He's come about the job.
Good, good. Tell him to come straight in and wait while I finish these.
In you go, lad.
Hawes & Co. was a wool firm on Canal Street with branches in both London and Yorkshire.
Sit down, Dawson. Seen me before, have you?
Sir?
You're staring.
It was like opening an office door and finding King Priam or Merlin sitting behind the desk.
Yes, sire. I have seen you before, sir.
Oh, where have we met?
Well, I've seen you on the Waverley Road tram with a group of young people.
All talking their heads off, eh?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my family's apt to behave as if it owned any tram it rides in, especially my youngest girl.
Has she got green eyes and is she always excited?
That's Bridget.
Young Bridget. Always sublimely careless of appearances.
You've been keeping your eyes open, Dawson.
I couldn't help noticing those girls, sir. There are two others, one fair and the other dark.
Well, the dark one is Joan, my eldest.
Joan of the cream skin and huge grey eyes.
And the fair one is Eva.
Smiling, downy, golden Eva.
Now look here, young fella. I didn't ask you here to talk about my family. Now tell me a bit about you.
Well, my mother was from the West Riding, but my father was from Kent.
Was, you say?
They died last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm an only child, so I moved to Brudersford and came to live here with my uncle and his wife in Brig Terrace.
Well, settled in all right, have you?
They are very good to me, sir.
Mm.
I found him easy to talk to, not patronising, not self-conscious, and I liked him. He tested my arithmetic, and I floundered through a little German, and it all went well.
Good. Good. Oh, by the way, any special interests, hobbies, enthusiasms?
Well, I try to write a little.
Huh? Verse or prose?
Well, both. And I read a lot. And I love music.
Good boy. Good boy. Now, I like all those things, too. I think we'll suit each other. Now, you can join us as soon as you like. Work in the sample room with Mr. Ackman. We'll pay you £1 a week.
All right, all right. Hello.
Dawson, Brent here.
Brent? What can I do for you? How's London?
Same as ever. Are you cracking that script?
Seems to be going well. Had a good day today, and should have another tomorrow.
Don't bet on it. Your star has arrived, just flown in from Hollywood.
Liz? She's supposed to be coming next week.
She wants to talk to you.
Put her on.
I sent her to bed. The air trip has shaken her up a bit. But the point is this. She insists on coming down to see you tomorrow to talk script.
Is there any chance of putting her off?
None whatsoever. She wants me to come with her. I've already booked two rooms for us at the hotel. I can only stay overnight. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. What were you doing? Mm-hmm. Drinking? Thinking?
No, just remembering some of my past.
Does Elizabeth Earle come into it?
Well, in 1912, she was just a toddler.
Right. Well, see you tomorrow.
I felt sad and lonely, and I didn't know why. Should I go downstairs for a drink? No. No. I knew then it was inevitable. If I wanted to go forward, I had to return and explore the past fully. So I settled back and picked my way again through the years to Brudersford and Canal Street and the Allington girls. I had been working at Hawes for several weeks. I hadn't seen the girls on the tram again, and Mr. Allington never said another word about them. But in spite of my disappointment, I was beginning to settle down to life in Brudersford. I joined the library. I attended the monthly symphony concerts in Gladstone Hall, where the Halle Orchestra thundered out Beethoven and Brahms. But I wanted then, as I've wanted since, that little more, that touch of the miraculous and the magical. Where were the girls and their mysterious world? They might have been blue butterflies and vanished with the sun. Then, suddenly, unexpectedly, I was in the office alone one afternoon, and it was as if an invisible demigod had pulled a string.
Can I help you?
Is my father in, Mr. Allington?
Sorry, he's just gone out, but I don't think he'll be long if you'd like to wait.
Would you give him this note? You're Gregory Dawson, aren't you?
Yes.
I'm Joan Allington.
Yes.
She of the cream skin and the huge grey eyes.
My father says you want to be a writer.
Yes.
And he says you like music.
And it came to me, like a great blue diamond of happiness. I existed, and the magic group knew it.
Do you go to the Music Society's concerts?
Well, I've just started.
See, we're going to one next Friday. They're doing Brahms 4th. Perhaps we'll see you there.
Yes. And then there I was, staring across the hall at the Allington group, assembled in full force. Mr. Allington was there, and a handsome woman who was Mrs. Allington. And there, were the bright cluster of girls, the three sisters. Joan recognised me and smiled and waved. And then they were all smiling and waving, and I felt like a child at Christmas.
Hello, Gregory. Enjoying yourself?
Yes, sir. They're playing very well.
Oh, indeed. Oh, this is Ben Kerry.
Hello. Hello.
And Jock Barniston.
How do you do?
You live in our part of the world, don't you, Gregory? You must break your journey after the concert, come back to the house and have coffee and cake with us.
Oh, yes, sir. I look forward to it. I'll meet you on the tram, Mr. Allington.
I shared a seat with Jock Barniston. He must have been in his 30s. But he talked to me as if I were the same age.
Bridget is seriously studying the violin. Oh, and you mustn't be afraid of Mrs. Allington. Lots of people think she's unfriendly, but she's actually just shy and reserved.
And Ben Kerry?
Is the brightest young man on the Bruddesford Evening Express.
Ben had silky, smouldering good looks that most women like, and I didn't then, and I don't now.
Some think he's ready for Fleet Street. He's half engaged to Eva Allington.
Here, I must digress on Jock Barniston. Jock was one of those rare persons who leave an enduring impression of integrity and strength with everyone who knows them. Perhaps he knew already, when he was talking to me in December 1912, that in 4 years' time, the body he had put on like an overcoat to wear before us would be so much bleeding meat in a sandbag. I think Jock came from a long way off to sit among us, to drink beer and coffee with us, to smoke a pipe and hear our troubles, and finally, to vanish in the slaughterhouse of the First World War. This was the man who paid my first fare to the Allingtons.
Gregory, have some cake.
That's Joan.
And some coffee. Eva, bring the sugar.
Eva, golden, dreamy, smiling, who seemed to exist in a transparent envelope.
Do you play or sing, Gregory?
No, not really. Do you?
Well, I sing a little, but I'm not much good.
No, you're not.
And Bridget, who was a little younger, harder, and fiercely, childishly sincere.
You write things, don't you? Do you read them to people?
No. At least, so far, I haven't.
A jolly good job, too. You may say that's unfair, because I'm always wanting to play my fiddle to people, but that's different.
It isn't, you know, darling.
Yes, it is, Eva. Music isn't embarrassing in the same way. I don't want poetry and stuff read to me. The person looks and sounds silly. And then I'm sorry, and then I'm furious, and oh, it's all a mess. And so, I warn you, Gregory Dawson.
I don't need to be warned. You needn't worry about me. I'm not going to read anything to you.
All right, keep cool.
Well, you started it, Bridget.
Oh, don't be ancient. You're getting jolly patronising these days, Eva. I'm going to get the music now and set up. We'll be playing soon. Come on, Eva. Come and help me.
Eva! Over here!
Coming, Ben!
Eva! She's got sidetracked by Ben Kerry, as usual. She won't like it if he goes to Fleet Street. Not one little bit.
Later, in the half-light, from across the room, I watched the grave, pale face of Joan. Then Bridget, sharply illuminated above her violin, her face taking on a kind of stern beauty. And sitting on the other side of the room, full in the light, was Eva the Golden. And thus seeing them mistily through the music, in that moment I think I fell in love with all three at once. At 18, when love is magic, it rises in us like a tide upon which the mind can float.
Mm.
Hello?
Brent here.
I was asleep.
We're just leaving. We'll be with you by tea time.
I worked flat out until 1:30, but the memories were persistent, pressing. So I went for a walk along the cliff path, and I found a little hollow where I settled down with my pipe for company. Then I was back in Bruddersford, in the sleet and dark of that far-off December, 1912. Christmas had arrived. Acres of rich cake and mince pies were washed down by cataracts of beer and port, whiskey and rum. And the air was fragrant with thick cigar smoke, as if the very mill chimneys had taken to puffing them. People lived then in a world and an atmosphere that I have never discovered again, not since 1914, when the guns roared and the corpses piled up.
Hello, Eva. You look lovely.
You look peculiar.
I think it's the mulled old ale.
Well, it's a peculiar party. Mr. Ackworth's always are.
Hello, Bridget. Are the others with you?
Only us three. Won't we do?
Joan. Yes, of course. It's marvellous. I never hoped to see you all here.
Gregory?
Bridget?
I don't understand you. Which one of us is it you're so keen on knowing?
Well, it's all three, really.
Oh, listen to that. I bet they'll be playing filthy kissing games soon.
Come on now, you young people. No skulking in the corners.
Oh, and here it comes.
All right, Mr. Ackworth.
Now, who's going out first?
Someone chose Joan, and then she chose me. And out I went to the hall.
Well, go on, Gregory. Not like that.
I was very shy. She was a piece of magic, and I was afraid of breaking the spell.
Like this.
It was a light kiss, but firm and very sweet. And sitting here on a Cornish cliff, 30-odd years later, such a weight of sadness fell on me that it seemed that I'd been dead for years and years, and not known it.
Now, who's your choice?
I would have asked Bridget, but remembering her disgust...
Eva, I think...
I knew it would be. You're all the same, you men.
I kissed Eva several times. It was very pleasant, but curiously unsatisfying.
Well, I think you're all disgusting. And it's rather a disgusting party.
When I got back, Bridget was eating candied fruit and looking grumpy.
Eating's the only thing to do here. And I'm jolly well going to eat myself sick.
But she changed her mind when...
Bridget! Have you brought your violin with you?
Now, two world wars away, I can still see her tender and serious passion.
Bye.
Walk back with me, Gregory.
All right.
Such a lovely night, and I want to clear my head.
Joan! Gregory! This way to the tram!
We're walking!
We'll freeze to death if you want to.
There's something I want to say to you.
Yes?
Something you can do for me. I didn't want anyone else to overhear. I'm worried about Father.
Why? There's nothing wrong with him, is there?
No. But I'm worried because sometimes he seems so worried, only just lately, and I think it might have something to do with the business. It can't be anything else. Sometimes he seems distracted and upset even when he comes back from work.
Oh. What do you want me to do?
Well, you're there in the office with him, and you must know a lot of things that we don't know. So, will you keep your eyes and ears open, and please tell me if you find out what's worrying him? Don't tell anyone what I've said, will you? I don't want Mother to know.
Of course not. But I'm sure there's nothing to worry about.
In the month that followed, Mr. Allington was away a good deal in Germany, or London. And I had nothing of much importance to report about him to Joan. But I did see a good deal of the girls. I was also writing, and had several short pieces accepted by the Evening Express. And spring came at last.
What a glorious morning!
A fine Sunday in late May. And Jock Barniston and I set out to visit the Allingtons at Broadstone Moor, where they rented a cottage. I had just bought a massive pair of brogues, and a shaggy Harris tweed suit. Jock wore his old faded tweed coat and appeared bigger and browner than ever. He always looked as if he'd been away to Patagonia, or the moon, or some other solar system.
But my sister was gloomy about it at breakfast.
About what? Today?
Yes, but not the weather. She said it would end badly for us all.
Well, what did she mean?
She's got a kind of second sight, you know, Dorothy. Sometimes when she's had a bad night, she tells me things in the morning.
Is she always right?
No, but usually. She was very definite about it this morning.
What does she say is going to happen?
Well, she didn't know. Or at least, if she did know, she didn't tell me.
Did she tell him he would die on the battlefields? It was hard to tell with Jock.
Hey, don't say anything about this to the Allingtons. Hmm? Now, how are things at Hawes?
A bit boring. New chap's coming up from the London office to learn the business. Name of Nixie. He's the nephew of some rich old boy who's more or less taken over in London. And I don't think Mr. Allington and Mr. Ackworth like the idea. I shan't stay much longer in the wool business, Jock. I want to write. Seriously.
Gregory, don't be in a hurry to run away.
Ben Kerry's going to Fleet Street.
It's easier to write about what you want in a wool office than it is when you're working for a newspaper.
But
Look. You're only a lad. Don't try to be clever. Keep it straight and simple and give it a few years.
We were out of Brudersford now, and as we turned to the hills, the last touch of haze vanished. The blue lifted and deepened, and the gold light seemed to have weight as well as warmth.
I should miss the Allingtons, though.
And you mustn't care too much about the Allingtons.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, I didn't mean that we mustn't be fond of other people.
But to me, the Allingtons are... I suppose if the girls weren't so good-looking. But it's the whole mysterious effect. I was on the outside of it, you see, and now...
Gregory, listen to me. You came here to Brudersford feeling lonely, bereft. Then you saw the Allingtons. Well, that's all right. But you mustn't make them stand for more than they ought to. You mustn't turn them into symbols. Magic shouldn't come in with people.
Well, it's got to come from somewhere.
Because life without magic soon begins to wither.
True. And magic does exist in the universe. Our ancestors knew that. But today we pretend it doesn't and then smuggle it in through the wrong door. Gregory. The Allingtons are an amusing, clever, charming family, and I'm fond of them. But don't turn them into something they aren't. Switch off the magic. It comes from you, not them. Don't cast a spell over yourself and imagine they're doing it.
Are you warning me against them?
No. But you can go a long way and give us something good if you travel easily and lightly, seeing people as they are and not leaving parts of yourself behind, frozen in some enchantment. Hey, look. There's the white horse, and it's open. Come on, let's have a beer.
By evident Jock Barniston.
Stanley Mervyn. Mervyn, this is Gregory Dawson, young friend of mine. Gregory, this is Stanley Mervyn. He is one of our finest landscape painters.
How do, Gregory?
We're on our way to the Allingtons.
So am I, lad, so am I. I've been out since early on having a go at that little bridge at Broadston Beck End. If I've had one try at that bigger, I've had a dozen. But I think I've got it this time. Look for yourselves, lads.
Oh. There, on the rough paper, with a glinting and dimpling stream, the stone arch of the bridge flushed with the morning sun.
The moors, the hills, you've caught them.
And he'd caught the time and the place.
Aye, it's a little miracle, Stanley.
It's beautiful.
I've seen some pieces of yours in the Evening Express. Not bad. Not bad at all. Only, look, lad, don't try to be too clever. Keep it straight and simple. Mm-hmm. You're only young yet. You've plenty of time. Wish I had still, but I'm getting on now.
Gave it all up, didn't you, Stanley? The regular job, the big house in town.
Aye. I wanted to paint more than anything. It was 20 years ago. I just used to do it at weekends. One morning, I said to Mrs., I'm not going into office. I'll be dead and buried before I can turn round. I'm packing it in. She said, nay, Stanley, we can't afford it, lad. I said, I can't afford not to do it, lass. She says, how are we going to keep house going? I said, what the omelette do you want to keep house going for? So we took a little cottage on the moors. And if I wanted to, I just went out and painted. And if I didn't, I didn't. It was hard going. Must have lived on a pound a week for the first year or two. But if you ask me, I've just about been happiest bloody man in Yorkshire since.
The Allington's cottage was set down in a hollow looking onto a small green. I remember we had a crowded, uproarious lunch with much argument at the table about the state of the world.
No, no, no. To my mind, war among the great powers is very unlikely indeed. Now, I'm in Germany a lot, and there's been too much bother and attention made over a small group of warmongers. People forget how strong German socialism and liberalism are becoming. Men aren't stupid enough to hurl millions of troops, thousands of great guns, battleships into the furnace of war.
What are they for, then? And all these cannons and machine guns and battleships.
To frighten the nations into keeping peace.
Don't tell me that. Stands to reason with all that stuff ready to go off. Somebody will pull the trigger one of these fine days.
You don't know anything about it, Stanley.
That's a fact, and neither do you, John. But I do know this. The more you lump folk together and let them read damn silly newspapers and give them big guns to play about with, then the bigger the bang will be when it comes.
War from now on will be lunacy. And collectively, people don't mind lunacy. They find it easier than sanity. Come on. Who's for cricket?
No, I don't.
I remember our side won by 27 runs. And I remember the blur of sunlight and green leaves and shining water. Later, as Jock and I walked back...
Mervyn's right. There will be a war. My sister has seen it. And we'll all be in it. I'll be in it. You'll be in it. I don't know whether she gets it from my mind or I get it from hers or we both get it from somewhere else. But there it is. Perhaps in a year or so.
I'm sorry, Jock. I don't believe it'll happen.
It's all right. Doesn't matter.
On our return to the Allington's house in Brudersford that evening, we waited for the music to begin.
Joan's happy now.
Why especially now?
She's got Jock all to herself.
Why does she want him all to herself?
She adores him. Didn't you know?
Are you sure?
Ask Bridget. Ask me what, Eva. Isn't Joan potty about Jock?
Oh, that. But we're just about to start.
I'll get us some drinks.
Are you ready to hear some music, Gregory?
Oh, not music again.
Gregory! Sometimes, you know, you're rather awful. But at other times, you're nicer than any of the chaps who come here. And you do care about music. I know, because I've watched you. So stop teasing.
I've never seen you watching me, Bridget.
I've had my eye on you. Did you know that I might go to Leipzig next year? To study? Will you miss me?
Ben Kerry had just arrived and was standing talking to Eva. Joan and Jock Barniston were still deep in conversation. Bridget put a hand on my arm. She turned to stare at me.
What's the matter?
I don't know. I don't know... Why can't we just hold on to what we've got and all agree that we won't have it changed?
The slow movement of the Schubert B-flat major trio, just as I'd heard it in the lounge of the Royal Ocean Hotel.
I say, excuse us, awfully sorry to interrupt. Mr. Allington? Mrs. Allington? I'm Nixie. Malcolm Nixie. We rang the doorbell several times, but couldn't make anyone hear.
Oh, come in, come in. Take a seat.
We're late, I know. Terrible journey from London. But I thought you'd like to know we'd arrived at last. This is my wife, Eleanor.
So sorry we interrupted.
Eleanor Nixie. A handsome woman with fine eyes, creamy skin. A dark swan queen. A lady from a far country.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dawson.
Oh, Lady Holdin. But the same Eleanor Nixie of my memory.
with 30 or more years on her.
Did I startle you?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I was just thinking of you.
Me?
Yes, I was deep in the past, at the Allingtons, 1913. You and your husband had just arrived.
The Allingtons. I do seem to remember. But it's all so long ago, isn't it? Are you coming back for tea? Everybody in the hotel's very excited about Elizabeth Earle coming here. She's such a great star.
She changed the subject rather too quickly. She was a bit too light and easy. And then, just as we came to the little gate on the cliffside of the hotel grounds, she touched my arm.
What was I wearing that night?
Wearing?
When I arrived.
I...
What was I wearing?
I've no idea.
One of those absurd picture hats, and a black crepe de chine hobble skirt, and a cream georgette jabot. Very grand and smart then, particularly for Brothersford.
I'll bet it was. Come in.
Darling.
Elizabeth.
Oh, it's so good to see you. Oh, it's been too long. You're thinner, Greg.
Oh, so wartime rations. And I'm not drinking as much as I did in Hollywood.
And greyer. But it suits you. What about me?
A shade more mature, but better than ever. Remember, though, I've seen hours of you on screen since I left Hollywood.
Do you know? Your room's just like mine. I'm underneath, and we have a special little staircase I can come up and talk to you.
You just be careful.
I thought you might have been downstairs waiting for me.
Yes, I meant to.
Ah, it's lovely to be back. But last night I cried.
Oh? Why?
I don't know. How are you really, Greg, darling?
I'm all right, Liz, thank you.
Oh, you're different somehow. Are you in love?
Oh, hell no. I'm 1,000 years old. When I'm not working on the script, I spend my time thinking of my distant past. About the time when you were just toddling. And that's all there is to say about me.
I'm not sure. Not at all sure.
I lit a pipe and we spoke about the film and the director and how Americans always want to see Britain as a fake Hollywood Britain.
Well, if I'm appearing downstairs for dinner, I suppose I'd better have a bath and change. Oh, can I take the first two sequences of the script with me?
Oh, yes, of course. Here you are. Ooh. And Liz?
What?
I'm glad you're here. Cheers then, Brent.
Here's to the lady hits back.
Yes. Now, what's the problem with Adonai?
He's worried because he's heard that Elizabeth Earle is in love with you.
Oh, rubbish. What's it got to do with Adonai anyway?
He says it might affect the film, and as its director, he has a right to know. Miss Earle is a great star. You are writing the script, and if you and she...
You can tell Adonai there's nothing of that sort between us. We're old and very good friends, that's all.
Here she comes, dead on time.
Wearing a long black dress. She looked vivid and happy, as if everything was a great treat.
You two look like conspirators. What have you been talking about?
You, of course, Liz. What else? Come on, let's go and eat. But don't expect too much. We're still on wartime rationing.
Look at them. Their hands are shaky. They are spilling their soup, and all because of you, Miss Earle.
But I was just thinking how nice it is when there's no fuss.
This is England, not America. And there is actually a terrible fuss here tonight.
It's true. They're all excited. They're trying to hide it. But the temperature is up by several degrees.
Movies and the power of movies. It's frightening. We talk of it as an industry or entertainment, but it's actually more, much, much more. What we're doing is filling a horrible vacuum where once there were gods and goddesses, and then afterwards saints and angels. You imagine, Greg, that Miss Earle is simply a good actress with a beautiful face and figure, but that's not so. She is now a magical image in the world's dream.
You look as if you're having a wonderful time, Liz.
I am, darling, I am. The script is grand, and it's such fun being here. I've never stayed in this kind of hotel before in England. Couldn't afford to on the kind of salary I used to get.
On the kind of salary you get now, you could afford to buy the damn place.
It's not the same thing. Do understand, Greg. I've been away for years and years. There are a couple of people over there waving to you.
Hmm? Evening. Good evening. I knew them years and years ago in Bruddersford. The old man and I worked together for a time.
Oh, is that why you've been thinking about your past?
I suppose so. The Nixies came over later, in the lounge during coffee. And to their great delight, I introduced them to Elizabeth and Brent. But suddenly I felt old, tired, stale. I found myself staring at Elizabeth as an old churchyard ghost might at a bride. I thought I might work on the script to take my mind off so many things. But somehow it didn't interest me anymore. I had felt 10 times more alive this afternoon on the cliff than I had talking to Brent and Elizabeth about Hollywood and films. I turned on one small light, leaving the turret end of my room lost in shadow. And there, as the night drummed unceasingly, I returned again to my youth.
I say, old man.
Yes?
I didn't quite get the hang of that.
Malcolm Nixie had been with us for 3 months.
Explain to me what it's about. Do you mind?
We had just had a meeting in the sample room, and I found myself helping him out yet again. He was always extremely pleasant and polite to everyone. Mr. Ackworth wasn't impressed, though.
Yon's a crafty beggar. If he's up to any bloody good here, then I'm a ring-tailed monkey. And if I were John Allington, I'd tell him in London that no matter who he is, I don't care if his uncle owns half the company, either I go or he does.
One morning, a youngish man arrived unexpectedly.
Good morning. I am Herr Hoffner from your German clients, and I wish to talk with Mr. Allington.
Certainly, of course. Mr. Allington is out at the moment, but if you'd like to take a seat...
Albert, how good to see you again.
Malcolm, I was hoping you would be present when I came here. I am sent to discuss about our firm's order for wool this season. Perhaps I might have a word with you about it.
Dawson!
But of course, Albert. Please, come this way.
Excuse me, Mr. Nixie.
I'm sure Mr. Allington won't mind our using his office.
Mr. Nixie!
Dawson, what the hangman did you want to let Nixie get hold of him for, you young donkey?
Don't start blaming me. He talked to Nixie because he knew him and he didn't know you.
Aye, that's what bothers me. One of our best overseas customers turning up here in person only months after Nixie comes to join us. I don't think Mr. Hafner came to see Mr. Allington at all.
Mr. Allington came back about 10 minutes later.
Now, Joe, don't go imagining elaborate conspiracies. Why shouldn't they be friendly? There's nothing in that. Probably Nixie took him about a bit when they were in London. They're about the same age.
I never knew such bloody cheek and impudence. Chap has hardly been here long enough to turn round. Knows as much about wool as I know about making toffee.
Joe, I've told you. All the same, I don't like the way Nixie behaved, taking him straight into my room like that.
John... Just listen and let me have me say, and then I'll shut up once and for all. I can bet you before long we can't get an order from Hafner's unless Nixie's summit to do with it.
Ah, Mr. Allington.
I'll hear what you have to say later, Joe.
And Mr. Allington hurried into his office to greet Hafner. Ackworth turned his attentions now to Nixie.
I don't know who or what you are in London, and I don't much care. But here, you're just a chap starting to learn the business and knows about as much as an office lad.
I'm doing my best. Any harm in that?
Aye. There's plenty of bloody harm in you marching Mr. Hafner off like that in Allington's room and all. Who the hell do you think you are, eh? When we want you to run this business and talk to one of our best customers, we'll ask you. But it'll be some time yet, let me tell you.
Mr. Ackworth, my uncle, Mr. Buckner, has recently acquired a large interest in this firm, and it was he who arranged for me to come here. And I happened to know Mr. Hafner, and he wanted to talk to me, so I took him to Mr. Allington's room, because I knew it was empty. If Mr. Allington objects, then he can tell me so. But don't forget, it's his room and not yours. Anything else?
Aye, there is. Just keep out of my way and stop interfering.
Later, Hafner and Nixie went out for a meal together. After they had gone, there was a half-defeated... melancholy feel about the place.
You know, Gregory, I always liked old Julius Hafner. kept his word. Hard old codger, but delightful. He's the old liberal Germany, not like his son. Albert's the new Germany, the one people are beginning to be frightened of. And perhaps they're right.
Hello, Joan.
Well, come in, you'll be drowned. There's only me here. Everyone else is out, except my parents are upstairs packing Daddy's bag. Sit. Now, how are you?
Actually, well, I came here tonight to talk seriously to one of you, and I think you're really the best.
Oh, as a matter of fact, I've been wanting to talk to you for some time. See, you promised to tell me about things at the office a while back, when I said I was worried about my father.
Yes, and I would have.
See, I'm far more worried about him now, and you're not telling me things.
I'm sorry, it's all been piling up at work.
I know. And something's upset him. I heard him say to Mother tonight that he didn't want to go dashing off to Germany again, but he just has to go. Why, Gregory? What's happening? Oh, they're coming down. Let's go for a walk.
Well, it's raining like mad.
We can shelter in that hut at the bottom of the lane. Now, tell me.
Mr. Ackworth thinks that Nixie isn't just here to learn the business. He wants to take over our office. And I agree with him. I've come to the conclusion that Nixie's out for everything he can get and that he's plotting and intriguing like mad.
Oh, I bet he is.
And after his visit, Hafner went back to Germany without giving us an order. That's very serious because his firm is just about our biggest customer and they always place an order with us. Yesterday, we had a letter from them saying they didn't intend to buy anything from us this season. Then this morning, your father said he'd have to dash off over there to look into things. Mm. Nixie came into the sample room and said that he ought to go and that Hafner told him it would be better for the firm if he did. And there was a terrific row and it ended up with Nixie not going to Germany but saying he'd have to go to London to tell his uncle and the other directors.
Oh, I knew something had happened. So did Mother. Oh, Gregory, it's awful. It's horrible.
Mm.
It feels as if something's creeping upon us. Evil coming to change and spoil everything.
Something's creeping upon us. Jock Barniston saw it.
Jock?
He said, after the picnic, that there's going to be a war. And that he'd be in it, and I would too. Joan?
Oh, Gregory.
I shouldn't have told you.
I knew she was weeping because she was in love with Jock and her hope of ever being with him was fading. I pulled her close to me and lifted her face and I kissed her damp, salty cheek. Then her arms were round my neck.
You're so sweet, Gregory. And if you were only 4 or 5 years older, I think I'd fall in love with you.
Her lips had that strange flavour of the sea. They flickered, then leapt into a wild, exciting life of their own, like a flame in that darkness. This was what it was all about. This was it. But I wasn't kissing her, Joan Allington, but any girl's warm, sweet lips, and she wasn't kissing me, but an image of someone else.
Stop it! Don't be so stupid!
Joan.
No, don't be a fool! I want to go home.
All right.
Now!
The rain has died down anyway.
I think I understood then how women could get treated roughly. Because I had such energy in me, roaring to be released, I had to dig my hands in my pockets.
I do not like being called those things by a girl who's just been kissing me like mad.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Gregory. I was angry at myself, really, not with you.
All right.
Can we forget it?
All right.
Then vague, insubstantial memories flashed by. Canal Street on darkening afternoons. Mr. Allington away. Ackworth worried. Until I arrived at a party given by a theatrical crowd in a pub. And they were there,
Nixie's wife Eleanor, looking smart, excited, and Ben Kerry, big, flushed, a bit tight. I knew at once that he had brought her, and that Eva's adored Ben and this handsome, reckless woman from London thought of themselves now as a pair. I waited until Ben had gone to the bar.
Hello, Mrs. Nixie.
Oh, you do pop up, don't you? Is this your kind of party?
Up to a point.
What a mob. I can't bear these second-rate theatrical people, but Ben said he thought I might be amused.
I hear that Eva Allington isn't very well.
That's the fair one, isn't it? She's probably anemic. I haven't seen those girls for some time. They don't interest me, you know, the way they do you.
I used to see Ben there a lot.
Yes, he's a friend of the family. The father's charming, I think, though Malcolm says he's not the world's brightest businessman.
Dawson, excuse us a minute, Eleanor.
Of course.
I heard what you were saying to her. What's the matter with you? I'd like to punch you on the nose. Can't you mind your own business?
I don't see that I wasn't. I first met you at the Allingtons, and I first met Mrs. Nixie there too, so naturally I mentioned them.
Dragged them in, you mean? It's nothing to do with you, who I'm seeing, so just you keep out of it.
If you keep still immediately after waking from a dream, you can usually remember it. That's perhaps where I went wrong, because try as I might for several minutes, I couldn't stir any more memories.
Who's there?
Can I come in?
I've been lying awake for ages listening to you pacing.
She sat down and smiled at me. She was wearing a velvet housecoat. She looked enchanting and knew it.
So I thought I'd pop up and see what's the matter.
Nothing. I hope I didn't wake you.
Of course not. Actually, I could only just hear you. But I thought it would be nice if we could talk. I was a bit worried about you downstairs in the lounge.
I'd had enough of it, so I came up here. That's all.
Is it the script?
Not the script.
What's the matter with you, Greg? It's as if I'm attending to you, but you're not really attending to me. As if most of you is busy somewhere else. I mean, you say you're not in love with anybody, but you behave just like a man who is.
I'm tired, that's all. We've had quite a war here, you know. This isn't America.
You said that meeting those dreary people, those Harndeans, had started you off remembering. Tell me what it's all about.
I think you ought to go back to bed.
I'm not sleepy.
It'll bore you.
Greg, I've been so looking forward to seeing you again, my very best friend.
And I've been looking forward to seeing you, Liz. I didn't mean for there to be a wall between us.
Tell me. Please.
I told her about going to Bruddersford, working at Hawes, entering the enchanted circle of the Allingtons, my altercation with Ben Kerry until...
Until?
The 31st of December, 1913. New Year's Eve and another party. At the Allingtons, this time.
All on your own, Gregory?
Hello, Bridget. Yes, Eva let me in, but then she disappeared.
Oh, she's talking to Ben.
He's no good for her.
She's absolutely balmy about him. And Joan's nearly as bad about old Jock. I don't know what's the matter with this family. Now, we're going to play charades. Will you and Ben pick sides? I'll be on yours.
We cleared a space for the acting.
By the way, you know there are still two people to come tonight. The Nixies.
They accepted your father's invitation?
Yes. They're late, of course.
They would be.
I don't think Ben knows they're coming. Eva does.
Ah. Oh. So you know about that, do you?
Doesn't everyone apart from Father and Mr. Nixie?
What about Eva?
Oh, I don't know. Shall we have goodbye for our word, then?
It's a bit easy, isn't it?
We can disguise it. Good is quite hard to spot. And in the next scene, we can have somebody saying bye-bye.
All right, then.
Ben's side would perform first.
Is everybody ready?
There were two scenes. The first was not very interesting or successful. But the next was more ambitious, with an oriental setting. The princess was Eva, who had ingeniously contrived an Eastern costume out of odds and ends and looked a ravishing and voluptuous beauty. She sat, haughty and silent, erect on her throne.
By God, we will last you a sight for sore eyes.
Joan was by my side, but she wasn't smiling at Eva like everyone else. I was surprised to see that she was glaring at her with narrowed eyes and tight lips. Then Ben Kerry appeared, a magnificent figure in turban and cloak made out of a green velvet tablecloth. He saluted the princess, knelt on one knee before her.
Most gracious, most beautiful Turandot, my life is at your disposal. To do with as you wish, my breath exists only to praise your beauty, which surpasseth that of all women. You are the brightest star in my heaven, and I exist only to serve you.
Arise, O my sultan.
And as he took her hand and kissed it in a final tableau, the Nixies walked in.
Evening, Mr. Allington. Everyone, so sorry we're late.
I hope we're not interrupting anything important.
No, not at all. Come in, come in. It's absolutely lovely to see you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Eleanor. Hello, Ben.
Well, I'd better go and get changed. Would you like to join in the charades, Mr. Nixie?
No good at it.
Have you ever tried?
Can't say that I have.
I always think it does people good to act the fool now and again. Come on, Gregory. Let's go to the attic and find some clothes for our play.
Looks as if your whole family history is up here.
It probably is. Oh, golly, I hate the smell of this moth stuff. I'd rather have moths. Take this. Oh, and those hats.
I've never been part of a family. Perhaps that's why you've had such a fascination for me.
We're not altogether what we seem, you know.
How are you not?
Well, Eva, for instance. She looks so pretty and sweet that everybody makes a fuss of her, but she's really rather silly. And she's awfully weak, but obstinate in a kind of dim way. The thing to do, really, about Eva is just to look at her and imagine things about her.
And Joan?
Oh, she's always been so good and responsible as the oldest and conscientious. But Joan's a sly boots, really. And somewhere inside her, she's got a nasty temper. Oh, I'd say this sounds rotten, doesn't it? And I am fond of them, really, but I thought I ought to tell you. You're so soft and sentimental, Gregory.
Who, me?
Yes, you. Although I'm the only one that sees it. And you'll have to be careful, or it'll slop over into all your writing.
I'm no softer or more sentimental than you are.
Of course you are. I'm not sentimental at all. I'm hard. But that doesn't mean I don't like you. Come here. Because I do.
Later, dressed up as fat people, stuffed and padded, the cheeks we blew out collapsed in laughter. Then, in a lumbering procession, bumping against each other, we went swaying and wheezing into the drawing room for the end of our charade.
Goodbye! Goodbye!
Sometimes this kind of happy idiocy can be raised to such a height that it takes on a kind of poetic glory, and often in the trenches, crouched in the dugout, that already smelt of the grave, I remembered it all with pleasure and with deep hope, going back, as it were, to warm my hands.
Listen, everybody, listen. We must stop here for a while. It's 12.
Oh, somebody's got to go outside to let the new year in.
Yeah.
Oh, it must be a man and he must be dark.
Yes. I'll go.
Yes, you go.
Mr. Nixie, no, not you. That's all wrong. Somebody else must.
Too late.
Ben, you go as well. Hurry, hurry.
Okay, right, hang on.
Get in there.
Well, who's going to let them in?
Eva, open the door.
Oh, yes.
Oh, Mrs. Nixie, you better go too and let your husband in.
Yeah. Oh, righty-ho.
Happy New Year, everyone!
Nixie and Ben making their formal entrance,
greeted by Eva and Eleanor, both women silent and looking perturbed.
Now, may I propose a toast? A toast to the new year. To 1914 and all that it will bring us. Peace, prosperity, friendship and love.
Aww. Well said.
To the new year. To the new year. 1914.
Peace, friendship and love.
Happy New Year.
No.
Eva, what's the matter?
Eva?
So, Eva did know about Ben and Eleanor.
Perhaps.
Oh, poor girl.
It's time you were away, Liz.
What happened to them?
Oh, it's too late to go into that now.
Greg, you're all mixed up about it, all muddled and confused, aren't you? Come here.
No. Go to bed now.
Greg.
Go, but, I said. Oh.
I can only stay in Cornwall another day or so. Will you promise to tell me to explain the rest before I go?
Why?
Because I'm interested and I care. And I want to understand.
All right, all right. Tomorrow.
Promise.
I promise. Now, good night, Liz. She left. But the memories remained, as if the doors and the cupboards and wardrobes were creaking open. The lids of old trunks lifting. Eyes watching from the shadows. And a young man, startled, turned his face towards me. And it was my face. My eyes. Rediscovering.
In Bright Day by J.B. Priestley, Gregory Dawson was played by Jack Shepherd. Gregory as a young man was Dean Smith. Joan was Sarah Smart, Bridget Sarah Churm, and Eva Lowry Evans. Elizabeth Earle was Liza Sadovy. Malcolm Nixey was Fred Ridgway. Eleanor Nixey, Janice McKenzie. Jock, Conrad Nelson. And Mr. Allington, David Fleischman. Mr. Ackworth was Finetime Fontaine. Brent and Stanley Mervyn, Seamus O'Neill. And Ben Kerry was Steve Marsh. Bright Day by J.B. Priestley was dramatised by Diana Griffiths, directed by Pauline Harris, and the concluding episode is at the same time tomorrow, when secret events are unlocked. Now, Neil Gaiman's new novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, is the book at bedtime next week over on BBC Radio 4. It's the story of a young boy whose life takes a strange and unworldly turn when he meets the Hempstocks, a family who live at the end of a winding lane. On a recent visit to BBC Radio 4 Extra, Neil Gaiman spoke to Nick Briggs about the book.
I'm interested to read that you started off writing Ocean at the End of the Lane as a short story. It just grew and grew and grew. How much do you sort of enter a fictional cocoon when you're writing?
You know, normally I do enter a fictional cocoon. I definitely, the rest of the world becomes less real while I'm writing. But normally I have a very good idea of structure. You know, when I was writing the Graveyard book, I went, good, I have this thing in my head and it's going to be 8 short stories, each of them taking place 2 years apart, and this will be the structure and this is how I will tell the story. And we will follow Bod from age 2 to age 16, and that was my story. With The Ocean at the End of the Lane, it's one of the very few times I've been absolutely surprised. I thought I was writing a short story. Then I thought I was writing a long short story. Then I thought I was writing a novelette. Then I realized I was probably writing a novella. And I even sent off an email to my editors saying, I'm writing a novella. I don't really know how we'll publish it, but just so you know, a little advance warning. And then I finished it, typed it all up, did a word count, and sent off a very surprised email to my editors on either side of the Atlantic, saying, I wrote a novel. I'm very sorry. I know it wasn't planned. I know you're not expecting it. I know it's not. You don't have a space for it on your publication schedule, and you probably wanted something else from me, but there's a novel that none of us were expecting. And plotting it, I think it's the most interestingly plotted of all of my books, because I genuinely didn't know where it was going. All I ever really knew while I was writing The Ocean at the End of the Lane was what I would probably be writing tomorrow. As I finished it, I knew what tomorrow's bit was. And E.L. Doctorow once compared novel writing for him, or at least writing a particular novel, to driving from New York to Los Angeles in the dark, but with your headlights on. He said you can't see very far, but you can see far enough to get all the way from LA to New York. For me, it was more like driving down a country lane at night in fairly thick fog with one headlight out. So I was driving relatively slowly, but I never went off the road, and I got where I was going in the end.
Yeah, it turned out all right then.
Nick Briggs there, speaking to Neil Gaiman about The Ocean at the End of the Lane. And you can hear Michael Sheen reading the book next week from Monday to Friday night at 10:45 over on BBC Radio 4. In an hour from now, a distinguished relative of Muriel and Vera arrives in Ballylennon. That's at 5 o'clock, but now it's 4 o'clock, which means it's time for mail.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello and welcome to the 4 o'clock show with me, Mel Gedroych. Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce you to the incredible, fabulous 4 o'clock show, Flea. Capable of amazing feats of dexterity and skill, please welcome Fleas and Thank You, one of the most agile and polite little entertainers in the insect entertainment world. Listen as he leaps from hand to hand. First my right hand, whoop, then my left, back to the right, and then a big finish as he tumbles in a triple axel somersault through the air and back onto my left hand. Hooray! Ladies and gentlemen, round of applause for the incredible Fleas and Thank You. Hooray! Oops. Call the paramedic. We've got a flea down. No, I'm only joking. No fleas were harmed in the making of this programme. Later, though, I'll bring you the story of the real-life flea circuses. We'll hear how the original insect attraction wowed disbelieving crowds with their incredible athleticism.
They had, say, six little fleas, and they'd have tiny little bits of coloured feathers fastened to them, and they were known as the ballerinas, and they did look as if they were dancing.
We'll also take a trip with an American carnival and meet the man who swallows neon tubes.
Usually they tell every sword swallower when they're first in the business, don't eat and then swallow swords. Well, I was the kind of person I'd eat and I'd swallow them anyway.
And in the next part of David Arman's story, the boy who swam with piranhas, the great Pancho Pirelli prepares to take a leap into the unknown.
Pancho unties the cord at his throat. The cloak falls from his shoulders. He's wearing blue swimming trunks. He holds the cloak out to Stan. Stan takes the cloak. Pancho climbs the ladder. He pulls his goggles down over his eyes. He leans over the edge of the tank. And in he goes.
First, oh yeah, it's time to hit the road. Cue that music. Let's head off across the globe, why don't we, to a brand new magical mystery tour location. I'll start you off in the right direction by saying our destination is a country in South America. It's the third smallest country on the continent and the only one where they speak English as an official language. Where could we be heading today? Stay tuned, I'll bring you more clues throughout the show.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
All week we've been enjoying the David Arman story, The Boy Who Swam with Piranhas, about Stanley Potts, the boy who ran away with the fair. It's a dream for a lot of people to run away with the fair, but one summer in 1994, BBC reporter Claire Hampson did just that. In this programme, Magic on the Midway, she meets some of the colourful characters who worked on one of the last old-time American travelling shows.
Yeah, ready, guys. Y'all set, sound that bell, guys. Let's do it, get to it, guys.
I knew I wanted to work in the States, but I didn't know where or what I wanted to do. And literally, I found this address of a carnival and just wrote off. But what I didn't know was that Claire in America is actually a man's name. And so they accepted me, and I rolled up one bright Sunday morning. And the guy who was running the carnival, his jaw just dropped because I was a woman, and he was stuck with me for the whole season. He tells me to go and put my stuff in the caravan. There's one really beaten down, really smelly caravan that everybody uses. And I didn't know any better, stuck my bag inside, went off to have a look around, came back about 5 hours later, and my bag had been rather unceremoniously tossed as far from the caravan as they could get it. And that was my first introduction to the rest of the carnies. That's it. I did spend the whole season sleeping amongst the fluffy toys.
Don't have to pay rent, don't have to worry about electric, don't have to worry about gas.
No bills, no problems, none whatsoever. This is it. Right here is where everything happens. It's wonderful. If it's a job for anybody. And like he says, I hate working. I worked at Burger King for 20 minutes. Here, I like.
Now, like for our show here, we sleep in the back of our station wagon and he sleeps on the stage. You've got a roof over your head. I've seen people when they even slept underneath a ride, you know, and at least you got shelter.